content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the July 17th, 2015 issue of The Week magazine, the main stories and how they were covered. Greece asks for one more bailout. What happened? Racing against a deadline from European creditors, Greece this week requested a three-year bailout loan to salvage its financial system before banks run out of cash, a catastrophic default that could force the nation off the euro. In return, Athens promised immediate economic reforms, vowing to overhaul its tax and pension systems. But Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras also insisted on major debt relief to show there is a light at the end of the tunnel. The loan request comes after months of contentious negotiations. Last week, Athens missed a crucial $1.7 billion debt payment to the International Monetary Fund, which had provided a five-year, $265 billion rescue package that required Greece to raise taxes and reduce spending, especially on public pensions. When Eurozone leaders demanded further austerity measures for extending credit, Tsipras hastily called a July 5th referendum urging Greeks to reject the bailout demands, which they did by a 61-39 margin. The prime minister hoped the resounding victory would strengthen his hand at the negotiating table, but the Eurozone took a hard line, threatening to cut off the cash flow unless Athens came up with an acceptable plan by July 12th. Greek banks are closed to prevent a run on deposits. Many experts fear that a Grexit, in which Athens would stop using the euro currency and go back to the drachma, could spark financial instability throughout Europe and the world. But European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker, said no major financial shock would occur. "We have a Grexit scenario prepared in detail," he said. What the editorial said: keep Greece in the Eurozone, said the New York Times. As Europe's most powerful leader, German Chancellor Angela Merkel must do the rational thing and restructure Greece's debt. While moralists argue that debt relief rewards a profligate Greek government, in reality, the austerity imposed by European leaders only made the crisis worse by creating 25% unemployment and reducing the country's GDP by another 25%. How does a country with a broken economy repay its debts? Let the Greeks go, said NationalReview.com. With its weak economy, Athens will never be able to pay what it owes. After a Grexit, the drachma can be heavily depreciated against the euro, substantially reducing Greece's debt. Letting Greece leave may weaken the euro as a force for European unity, but it's the only way to face reality. What the columnist said: Europe's leaders should come to their senses and provide the bailout, said Katrina van den Heuvel in the Washington Post. The Greeks overwhelmingly rejected the ruinous austerity policies that pushed their country into a depression. Now Europe must show adult leadership and give the Greeks some hope, starting with less draconian austerity measures and the freedom to cut spending on their own terms. Greece's best bet is bankruptcy, said Stephen Moore in the Washington Times. Like Detroit, the country should be put into receivership so it has a chance to restructure its debts and hit the restart button to rebuild its economy. For 6 years, the Eurozone brainiacs have been lending like they were giving crack cocaine to drug addicts. As a result, Greece is sitting on an unpayable $350 billion debt with a population that believes fat pensions and cradle-to-grave welfare benefits are human rights that can never be taken away. To be sure, the Eurozone is better off without Greece as a constant thorn in its side, said John Fund in NationalReview.com. And without Europe to blame for its problems, maybe Greece will finally do the right thing, kick out its incompetent socialist leaders, return to the drachma, and adopt responsible fiscal policies, such as paying their income taxes. Greece must eventually leave the euro, but its exit must be managed by Europe, said Eric Beinhocker in BloombergView.com. The alternative is a chaotic exit with huge defaults and more human suffering. Instead, Eurozone leaders should help Greece transition to a new drachma economy by providing debt relief and other assistance. That might encourage more defections from the euro in the decades to come, but that's preferable to Europe's current state of chronic crisis. While we're on this first page from the It Wasn't All Bad section, for the first time in 16 years, the U.S. women's national team won the World Cup this week, trouncing Japan to become the first three-time soccer champion. The 5-2 final drew 26.7 million TV viewers, more than any other soccer match in U.S. history. And with good reason. Within the first 16 minutes, the American team scored four goals. Carly Lloyd scored three of them, including a jaw-dropping 50-yard kick from midfield that sailed just over the fingertips of Japan's backpedaling goalie. Her three-goal hat trick had the crowd of 50,000, including Vice President Joe Biden and his grandkids, roaring and chanting, "USA, USA, USA." Lloyd, 32, was declared the tournament MVP and awarded the Golden Ball Trophy. "The energy in the air was unbelievable," she said. "A lot of us needed to pinch ourselves to see if it was really happening." The day after the game, President Obama called to congratulate the players and invited them to the White House. He also singled out Lloyd for her impressive streak of goals. "That's pretty good," he teased, asking why she couldn't manage a fourth. This weekend, New York City will host a ticker tape parade for the team. The controversy of the week, Trump, what his surge means for the GOP. "How do you solve a problem like the Donald?" asked David Drucker in WashingtonExaminer.com. Donald Trump, the billionaire real estate mogul and Republican presidential candidate, has seen his poll numbers zoom upward after he attacked Mexican immigrants as not the best people, calling them rapists, drug dealers, and criminals. Polls of likely GOP voters in Iowa and New Hampshire, as well as nationally, now show him in second place behind Jeb Bush, ahead of supposedly more viable candidates such as Scott Walker and Marco Rubio. This gathering Trump-NATO is causing Republican leaders some serious anxiety, and his surge in the polls all but guarantees Trump a spot in the upcoming GOP debates, where his rhetoric about Hispanics and his withering dismissals of his fellow candidates as pathetic and weak will be in bright spotlight. "Trump stands no chance of being president," said Jonah Goldberg in LATimes.com. "But by tarnishing the Republican brand and alienating badly needed Hispanic voters, this egomaniac has huge potential to deny his alleged party a White House victory in 2016. "If Republicans are smart," said Tony Norman in Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, "they will use Trump to their advantage. If the party feels it has an unfair reputation for being hostile to minorities, why not make a sacrificial offering of the bizarrely coiffed bigot and denounce his noxious views as harshly and loudly as possible?" Trump's remarks were a big fat hanging curve for the enterprising Republican 2016 candidate to swing hard at, said Simon Malloy in Salon.com. But only Jeb Bush, Rick Perry, and Marco Rubio denounced the comments. After all three initially tried to dodge the issue, whereas Ted Cruz actually went so far as to call Trump terrific and praise him as a man who speaks the truth. Maybe that's because Donald Trump has a point, said Rich Lowry in Politico.com. His comments about Mexicans were typically crude, but there was a kernel of truth to his rant. Fact is, we aren't raiding the top 1% of Mexicans and importing them to this country. Mostly, we're getting poorly educated people who are not suited to thrive in our modern American economy. They work hard, but 57% still rely on means-tested government benefits. Don't dismiss Trump as a mere buffoon, said Gerald Sieb in WSJ.com. Ever the savvy marketer, Trump has homed in on an issue, immigration, that resonates deeply with white working-class Americans. Republicans need to find an alternative way to tap into voters who are buying Trump's simple but angry narrative of a declining nation sabotaged by its stupid political leaders. Trump's hateful views may indeed resonate with many Americans, said Peter Werner in the New York Times, but they shouldn't. We conservatives need to distance ourselves from this pernicious figure on the American political landscape who traffics in racism, anti-vaxxer conspiracy theories, and malicious attacks on nearly everyone, including other Republicans. The people who have to confront and expose him are conservatives, since we're the ones who have the most to lose if he stays in the race. I'm sure GOP masterminds will eventually find a way to solve the Trump problem, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. But their current strategy, ignoring him and hoping he goes away, is not going to get it done. Trump's candidacy may be a farce, but for Republicans, it's a farce to be reckoned with. It was a good week for revenge. After a Texas judge awarded $229,500 in damages to a woman who had received 153 robocalls from Time Warner Cable attempting to collect a bill she didn't owe. It was a good week for heavyweight championships after Japanese robot maker Tsudobashi agreed to pit its 9,000-pound battle bot Karatus against the 12,000-pound U.S.-made Megabots Mark II, but only in hand-to-hand combat. Just building something huge and sticking guns on it, it's super American, said Tsudobashi's CEO. It was a good week for a walk on the beach after California officials announced that they would open a public access pathway to Malibu's so-called Billionaire's Beach, ending a decades-long battle with homeowners who were trying to keep the coastline exclusively private. It was a bad week for procrastination after a Michigan woman was arrested, frisked, fingerprinted, and briefly jailed for failing to renew her dog's $10 license. Becky Rare said she was pretty nervous when she was put in a cell with all these inmates in orange jumpsuits. It was a bad week for good old boys after TV Land announced it will pull reruns of the iconic 80s TV series The Dukes of Hazzard because the show's signature car, the General Lee, is emblazoned with the Confederate flag. And it was a bad week for flights of fancy after a Calgary, Alberta man was arrested after he flew over the city in a lawn chair affixed to 100 helium balloons and had to parachute out when he rose too high. I was looking down at a 747, said Dan Boria. It was surreal. On the briefing page, the coyote in the backyard. Coyotes have migrated from the West into suburbs and cities from New York to Atlanta. Is that worrisome? Where are coyotes found? Today, almost everywhere. Once mostly limited to the western plains, coyotes have moved steadily eastward and established new habitats in and around populous cities. Small packs roam city parks in New York, Chicago, Washington, D.C., Pittsburgh, and Atlanta, and they are becoming a particular nuisance in suburbs in the Northeast. 10 years ago, it was rare to see coyotes, but they have really exploded on the scene here, said Stamford, Connecticut Police Captain Richard Conklin. Every eastern state is now home to tens of thousands of coyotes. In 2005, hunters and trappers killed 20,000 of them in Pennsylvania alone. And these are not your great-grandfather's coyotes. Western coyotes are still the smallest predators and scavengers they always were, averaging about 30 pounds. The ones that have come east in the last 50 years, though, are big. Why are they bigger? The northeastern coyote is actually a wolf-coyote hybrid. Scientists believe the crossbreeding happened when the wolf population around the Great Lakes was on the verge of extinction and lonely wolves found mates wherever they could. Hybrid coyotes began filling the void wolves left, migrating east, and then south. There's not a lot of wolf DNA in the eastern coyotes, less than 10%, but that's enough to give the animal a more menacing aspect and enough heft to bring down an adult deer. Weighing up to 65 pounds, the eastern coyote has a larger skull and is even smarter and more adaptable than its western cousin. People look at our coyotes and think they're wolves, said Marion E. Larson of the Massachusetts Division of Fisheries and Wildlife. They're about the size of a German shepherd, maybe bigger. Why are they in cities? That's where the food is. Coyotes can eat just about anything, from animals as big as deer to insects and even fruit and grass. Cities and suburbs teeming with squirrels, rats, and pets, not to mention restaurant scraps, are a cornucopia for them. And because they are extraordinarily adept at eluding detection, they have managed to move in without being noticed until the past few years, when their numbers have increased so fast that sightings have become common. They can adapt to any urban landscape, said Smithsonian Institution geneticist Christine Bozarth. They'll raise their pups in drainage dishes and old pipes. Are they dangerous? Not usually. There's been only one confirmed killing of a human in the past decade, and just isolated reports of children being bitten. Coyotes do, however, like to eat pet cats, and sometimes attack smaller dogs that are trapped in yards by chains or electric fences. In a 2009 study in Tucson, cats were found to be urban coyotes' favorite meal, making up 42% of their diet. A coyote can jump a six-foot fence and take a small dog or cat and be back in a flash, said Tucson biologist Lisa Harris. In some scary cases, coyotes have attacked dogs while the owners were walking them. Experts also warn that rabies can make coyotes more aggressive. Still, the danger from the coyote has been blown out of proportion, said former wildlife officer Nikki Petronio. It's a wild animal, but it's not a vicious killing machine. Can they be culled? Coyotes are so resilient that killing them, even in great numbers, just doesn't have much effect. Decades ago, several western states tried to reduce coyote numbers through poisoning, trapping, and bounty hunting. But wildlife officials found that 70% of the entire population had to be killed every year to make a dent in the numbers, an impossible target. Coyotes also have a biological mechanism that triggers larger litters whenever their numbers drop. Do they provide any benefits? Yes. Coyotes keep down both the rat population and the Canada goose population. Coyotes raid goose nests, eating some of the eggs and burying the rest of them to be eaten later. In Chicago, nuisance Canada geese were increasing by nearly 20% a year. Now, thanks to the coyotes, the population is almost steady. And while coyotes don't kill enough deer up north to make much of a dent in the exploding deer population, they do keep numbers in check in the southern U.S., where the deer are smaller. In fact, by eating deer and mice, they may be helping to control Lyme disease, which is spread by deer ticks. What should people do? To protect your pet, do not leave it unsupervised or chained up in the yard. Don't leave pet food or scraps outdoors, and seal garbage lids tightly. If you do see a coyote, do not run away, which can trigger the animal's predatory instincts. Instead, yell and flap your arms and try to appear large and aggressive. The reality is, coyotes are incredibly adaptable, intelligent, resilient animals, and they have learned how to coexist with us, said Camilla Fox of California's Project Coyote. But we're still trying to figure out how to coexist with them. Rare human attacks. Coyotes instinctively fear humans and usually run away when they see one. But there have been some rare exceptions. In 2009, Toronto folk singer Taylor Mitchell, 19, was killed by coyotes while hiking alone in Cape Breton Highlands National Park in Nova Scotia. Four other hikers found her, bleeding profusely from a bite wounds all over, a coyote standing over her. She died of blood loss that night. Animal control officers killed four coyotes found in the area over the next few weeks, and three of them were found to have traces of Mitchell's blood on them, suggesting that she was attacked by a group. The only other known fatality from a coyote attack came in Glendale, California in 1981, when a coyote dragged Kelly Keene, 3, from her driveway. She later died of a broken neck. Because they are small, children are more likely to be attacked by coyotes, and there have been dozens of recorded non-fatal attacks on kids. Before we go on to the columns, there's a People article I thought you'd like. Copeland's Leap of Faith. Misty Copeland has broken the mold of the classical ballerina, says Jane Mulcairns in the Daily Telegraph. The 32-year-old has just become the first African-American woman to be named principal dancer by the prestigious American Ballet Theatre. She also has an unusually muscular body, quote, curvy by ballet standards, and joined the world of ballet late, taking her first lesson at age 13. But Copeland is proud of being different. There are people who say that I don't have the body to be a dancer, that my legs are too muscular, that I shouldn't even be wearing a tutu, that I don't fit in. The whole ballet aesthetic, she says, is racist. George Balanchine, the legendary choreographer, created this image of what a ballerina should be, skin the color of peeled apple, with a prepubescent body. So when people think of ballet, that's what they expect to see. Copeland can pinpoint the moment she began to overturn those expectations. It was the night I danced The Firebird at the Metropolitan Opera House in June 2012. I had never seen an audience that was 50% African American. It was overwhelming that so many of them were there to support what I stood for. And the columns now, two from the U.S. The first, How Grace Changed the GOP. An act of grace has utterly transformed the debate over the Confederate flag, said Peter Wenner. For decades, Republicans defended the display of this symbol of slavery, segregation, and white supremacy out of fear of alienating white Southern voters. And then, in the blink of an eye, it was over. Within days of a disturbed white racist killing 9 worshipers in a black church in Charleston, South Carolina, politicians throughout the South were calling for displays of this divisive symbol to be taken down. Why? It wasn't the killings alone. It was the enormous grace shown by relatives of those slain who somehow bestowed Christian forgiveness on the shooter when he appeared in court. Instead of rioting and continuing the chain of hate, black and white members of the Charleston community responded to a terrible act of racist violence by marching peacefully together in grief and solidarity. demonstrating the same kind of love, dignity, and strength once embodied by Martin Luther King Jr. In doing so, they moved hearts in a state and a nation. They even changed the Republican Party. Term limits for the Supremes. If there's one thing conservatives and liberals can agree on, said Erwin Kamerinsky, it's that Supreme Court justices have far too much power. In the wake of the Obamacare and same-sex marriage rulings, Senator Ted Cruz proposed last week that the justices face retention elections so that they could be recalled if their decisions were too unpopular. But that would just make the court even more overtly political. A much better reform would be the introduction of fixed 18-year terms for Supreme Court justices. Lifetime terms are more feudal than democratic and enable individual justices to cling to their tremendous influence into their 80s. And under the current system, it's completely arbitrary how much sway each president holds over the makeup of the court. While Jimmy Carter didn't choose a single justice, Richard Nixon got to select four, shaping the court's political outlook for a generation. Fixed, non-renewable terms would create a vacancy every 2 years, giving all presidents the chance to equally influence the court and cycling in fresh legal minds. No other country has lifetime tenure for judges. Why should we? From Ireland, why we're no better than Greece. There's a new fairy tale going around Europe that casts Ireland as the good child and Greece as the bad, said Fintan O'Toole. In this make-up story, which Prime Minister Enda Kenny has told in the form of a patronizing lecture to Greeks, Ireland emerged from its debt crisis by dutifully taking its medicine. Ireland, Kenny claims, did not raise income taxes, value-added taxes, or social security taxes, but balanced its budget by slashing programs instead. That is a blatant lie, in fact. All three taxes were very substantially increased. But by holding up Ireland as the pride of Europe, European lenders can pretend that economic crises are rooted in the behavior of each errant country, that is, their reckless borrowing and spending, rather than the reckless lending by German and other banks. Greece should never have been let into the euro and only met the membership criteria by cooking the books, working with Goldman Sachs to hide its debts with currency swaps. After the 2008 crisis, the banks that lent so recklessly were bailed out, and Greece was left holding the bag. The idea that Greece is to blame for its woes and should have been more like goody-two-shoes Ireland is a destructive fiction, one that we Irish should denounce. Turn now to the last word, our in-depth article, titled this week, Prepared for the Collapse. Preppers think society will soon crumble, said Rod O'Connor, so they're stockpiling food, water, and weapons. By all appearances, Bob Valenti is your average upwardly mobile suburbanite. The 40-something father of two has a couple of advanced degrees and a high-paying job at a high-flying technology company. He has an aggressive retirement plan and plenty socked away in college funds for his kids. As of last year, he also has a plan for surviving the end of the world as we know it. A few years ago, Valenti, who asked that his real name not be used for reasons that will be clear soon enough, and his wife traded their Chicago townhouse for a gorgeous 800,000 residence in Downers Grove, a suburb west of the city. The idyllic 12-room house features handsome walnut cabinetry, a sprawling yard, and a basement that holds the beginnings of what will ultimately be a year's stockpile of food and emergency supplies. Valenti recently ordered a box of 50 lighters and is squirreling away batteries, which he believes could someday be highly valuable for bartering. He has 25 pounds of meat in his freezer and another 50 at an undisclosed location out of town that he refers to as Plan B. Should he and his family need Plan B, he has a couple of 30-pound packets of survival seeds there for jump-starting their own farm. Valenti, who otherwise seems like a perfectly reasonable man, is preparing for society's collapse, which he believes could come any day now in the form of a global pandemic or the implosion of our highly leveraged financial system. All of a sudden, you have hyperinflation, and you'll need a wagon of cash for a loaf of bread, he says as we chat in his immaculate kitchen while a cleaning woman vacuums in the next room. Society could crumble in 3 days. That's all it would take. Then it's going to get primal. For most people, the term survivalists, or the more polite preppers, conjures images of tinfoil hat-wearing conspiracy theorists holed up in Montana hoarding canned pinto beans and assault weapons. National Geographic Channel's hugely popular Doomsday Preppers, which spotlights fanatics who build bulletproof shelters out of train cars to wait out Armageddon, or dress their families in matching hazmat suits, reinforces the extreme stereotypes. So do the doom-boom opportunists who peddle nuke-proof multi-million-dollar luxury condos in abandoned missile silos, complete with spas, rock-climbing walls, hydroponic farms, and HDTV windows programmable to the pre-apocalyptic view of your choice. Valenti is just one example of how the prepper movement has climbed out of the bunker and established itself quietly along affluent streets and suburbs around the country. Wason Johnny Tsai, chief instructor at the Combined Universal Martial Application Survival School, looks the hardcore survivalist part, but says that his students don't. Over the past few years, participants in his classes at the Chicago School have included doctors, lawyers, and upper management types who live in upscale city neighborhoods and hoity-toity surrounding towns. Tsai tells me that he trains individuals for the possibility, not the probability, of hardcore disasters and civil unrest. They come to him to learn how to build makeshift traps for catching their own food and light fires with a metallic rod and Vaseline-soaked cotton ball after the stuff hits the fan, or SHTF in prepper speak. With every new epidemic or terrorist attack in the headlines, a new batch of preppers is born, said David Scott, whose Northbrook, Illinois company Life Secure sells everything from crush-resistant earthquake survival kits to fireproof masks designed for fleeing a bombed-out building. We think of it like sediment, he says, of the movement that he, of course, has a stake in stoking. Another headline comes, and another layer forms. It was last fall's Ebola outbreak that made Valenti suddenly feel he was ill-equipped to protect his family if a pandemic disease were to spiral out of control. I thought, why am I not more prepared for this, he recalls. I fear the government isn't very prepared. I don't have any confidence that Chicago can handle it. Chicago just figured out how to handle major snowstorms. Within days, Valenti kicked off his own efforts. He walks me down to the basement and cracks open two large plastic storage trunks. Inside one is a 6-gallon bucket containing 330 servings of Just Add Water meals with a 20-year shelf life, a water purifier you can drop in your tub, which can store 100 gallons of drinking water, and a military-grade first aid kit complete with sutures, splints, and a hand crank emergency radio. The other trunk holds 3 15-gallon containers of gas. Valenti's largest-scale effort, Plan B, is an outwardly innocuous summer house that's been in his wife's family for years. It's the property that he and a handful of like-minded friends and family members have designated as their safe haven if they need to, A, wait out a short-term threat, or, B, start from scratch. Hence the survival seeds. Valenti won't tell me where this house is, except that it's a few hours' drive away, is near the woods, has a virtually limitless water source and is easily defendable. On site is a small arsenal of multiple rifles, guns, and pistols, along with 3,000 rounds of ammunition. No one other than those in on Plan B knows about his new hobby. Not coworkers, not friends, not extended family, and especially not the guy next door. This is about survival. I only want to talk about it with the people I'll be surviving with, he says matter-of-factly. Mostly, I don't want my neighbors to know about it because I don't want them knocking on my door when the stuff hits the fan. Preppers are, not surprisingly, a paranoid bunch. Locating people willing to speak with me about their habits was more challenging than finding vegans at a gun range. After emailing a dozen members of Northern Illinois Preppers, a meetup online community whose membership has grown from about 110 to more than 150 in the past 6 months, I received two responses. One was from someone who told me to take a hike. The other was delivered via a peer-to-peer encrypted email service, chewing me out for asking about his prepper efforts. Then I casually mentioned this assignment in an email exchange with a former colleague, an advertising executive who lives on Chicago's north side. I was surprised to discover a closet prepper in my midst. I'm sure you want people a lot more hardcore than me, wrote my friend, whom we'll call Pete Campbell, but I'm a bit of a prepper. I probably have some materials and views that could get me seriously put on a watch list. Plus, I don't want people knowing I got the goods when they get desperate. We agree to meet at a bar near his place. When I arrive, he's already there, sitting in a booth and sipping a craft beer. After some small talk, he tells me that if things go from pudding to poop, as one prepper so eloquently posted on a chat board, his primary concern is getting out of the city, which would have the highest concentration of desperate, unprepared types. Since he's a condo dweller with little space, his bug-in plan is limited. Two cases of military-issued MREs, meals ready to eat, that could last him a month, and three firearms, an AR-15 rifle, a 38 caliber revolver, and a 45 semi-automatic pistol. For the trek out of the city, on foot if necessary, he has a carefully constructed bug-out bag, which some preppers refer to as a 72-hour kit or an INCH, I'm Never Coming Home bag. Preppers really relish their acronyms. If something goes down, I grab this bag and a couple other things and get out the door, he says. Once the roads become impassable, I throw this on my back. My plan is to make it 72 hours and figure it out from there. He places the compact 25-pound pack on the table and starts talking me through its contents. Water packets, protein bars, survival rations, a tent, light sticks, a first aid kit, and one of those foil thermal blankets that are draped over finishers at the end of a marathon. Everything is individually packed in plastic bags in case he has to wade through a river or endure a rainstorm. He doesn't consider himself an extremist. As soon as the power goes out, I don't pull out the supplies. I like to think I have a firm enough grasp on reality that I am comfortable with my level of prepping. For me, it's a hobby I hope I never have to use. A lot of people have figurines on glass shelves that they display. I'm collecting peace of mind. Mark Trapp, a corporate attorney, and his wife, Karina, invite me to sit on the couch in their sunny living room in Glenview, Illinois. A large portrait of Abe Lincoln lords over the proceedings. The bookshelves lining the walls are filled with tomes on Reagan and Churchill, as well as a few zombie books. Their clan of seven convenes every Monday night to pray and to discuss whatever is on anyone's mind. One evening last fall, 17-year-old Eleni brought up the topic of emergency planning, which she had recently learned about at school. Soon the conversation progressed from blizzards to the quintessential prepper novel, One Second After, which she had recently read, detailing the aftermath of an electromagnetic pulse attack. Newt Gingrich wrote the foreword. Eleni, who has braces and hipster glasses, asks her parents how prepared they were for a serious disaster such as an EMP. Putting the kids to bed that night, I thought, what if something bad happened? Karina recalls. What do we say to our kids? Sorry, we didn't prepare. The concept of prepping wasn't new to the Trapps. They're practicing Mormons, members of a religion that stresses self-reliance. All members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints are encouraged to have an emergency plan that includes at least a 3-month supply of food and, ideally, up to a year's worth of long-term storage. And while not every practicing Mormon follows this rule, it is actually a full-blown commandment. The Trapps have made up ground quickly since last fall. We may not be far up in the Mormon totem pole, Mark says, with a laugh about the size of the family's survival stash, but we're pretty far up there compared with most people just by virtue of the little that we've done. We walk down to the basement, where shelves across the back wall are filled with food. Boxes of Cap'n Crunch and Cheez-Its are stacked 10 high near the crawl space, which the family might clear out for additional storage. 24 cases of water sit under a table. All told, the Trapps are closing in on enough food and supplies to last about 3 months. We discuss whether, as many preppers believe, society is more dangerous now than in the recent past, as reports of school shootings, terror attacks, and global pandemics have become routine. I don't know if we're the only ones feeling it, but there's this sense that times are different now, he says. It's sort of like the middle is not holding. Things are fraying, and I think more and more people are coming to the conclusion that if something is going to get done, you may have to do it yourself. That includes protecting his family if a disaster triggers mayhem in the streets. Those who are ready to deal with it are going to do much better than those who aren't, he says. The social contract is potentially written on very thin paper when stuff goes down. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in Chicago Magazine. On the health and science page, mosquitoes bring chikungunya to the U.S. Mosquitoes, once limited to tropical regions, are spreading north to the U.S. carrying both dengue fever and chikungunya, a virus that causes fever, chills, headache, and a punishing joint pain that can persist for years. Once a relatively obscure illness limited mostly to Africa, chikungunya has transformed over the past decade into a global menace. The disease, whose African name means to walk bent over, is carried by the tiger mosquito and Aedes aegypti, two species that are fast spreading to new areas around the world. These mosquitoes also carry dengue fever, which causes severe flu-like symptoms and infects 100 million people worldwide a year. Researchers at Oxford University created global distribution maps of the two species and found concentrations growing in China, southern Europe, Brazil, Mexico, and the U.S. So far, the invasion has resulted in more than 1 million chikungunya infections in Latin America and the Caribbean, and 11 cases in Florida. More than 2,300 Americans came down with the disease last year after trips to the tropics. Most people recover after several weeks of misery, though some develop chronic joint pain. If pregnant women are infected, their fetuses can develop neurological problems. Researchers warn that the virus may gain a foothold in Florida and spread north as mosquitoes adapt to temperate climates or respond to global warming. Chikungunya, infectious disease expert Stephen Hughes tells Popular Science, could become widely distributed in the U.S. There is currently no vaccine or treatment for either chikungunya or dengue fever. Nature's cure for anxiety. People tormented by an endless stream of negative thoughts can greatly benefit from an alternative to expensive psychotherapy or medications. A Walk in the Woods. Psychologists at Stanford University found that strolling outdoors in natural settings can stave off the human tendency to dwell on that breakup, layoff, or family problem, the Washington Post reports. The study involved 38 city dwellers with no history of mental illness. Half of the participants strolled for 90 minutes through an unspoiled landscape or surrounded by greenery. The others walked along a busy downtown street. Before and after their walks, the participants underwent a brain scan and questioning about how often they engaged in rumination, inward self-referential thinking, which is tied to depression and anxiety. The nature walkers brooded far less, and their brain scans revealed reduced activity in the subgenual prefrontal cortex, the region that regulates negative emotions. This provides robust results for us that nature experience, even of a short duration, can decrease the pattern of thinking that is associated with the onset, in some cases, of mental illness, says the study's lead author, Gregory Bratman. One downer, by 2050, about 70% of the world's population is expected to reside in cities. Predicting Alzheimer's. For decades, medical investigators have used sophisticated technology to search for warning signs that predict the onset of Alzheimer's disease, hoping that early detection might lead to a treatment for the devastating progressive brain disorder. Now, CBS News reports, scientists have deployed decidedly low-tech methods, basic memory and thinking tests, to suggest that Alzheimer's symptoms can appear 2 decades before doctors make a definitive diagnosis. Researchers at Chicago's Rush University Medical Center tested more than 2,000 people with an average age of 73 every 3 years for 18 years. During the first year, the lowest scores were 10 times more likely to develop dementia associated with Alzheimer's, said the study's author, Kumar B. Rajan. Efforts to successfully prevent the disease may well require a better understanding of these processes near middle age. On the Talking Points page, Religious Freedom, the Next Gay Rights Battleground. When love wins, it doesn't take prisoners, said Katrina Trinko in USA Today. Just 2 weeks after the Supreme Court legalized gay marriage in all 50 states, it's already clear that those who object to the ruling on religious grounds will be punished unless they succumb. Liberal columnists immediately began suggesting that all religious organizations opposed to gay marriage should be stripped of their tax-exempt status. In southern states, government officials who refused to conduct gay weddings because it violated their beliefs were quickly browbeaten into line. And in an ominous court ruling in Oregon, a Christian couple was fined $135,000 for refusing to bake a wedding cake for two lesbians. This is the next big battleground for gay rights, said Sam Baker in NationalJournal.com. Conservatives believe that business owners who oppose gay marriage on religious grounds shouldn't be forced to offer their services for gay weddings, so they're trying to expand existing religious freedom legislation. When Indiana Governor Mike Pence tried to do exactly that in March, he had to water the bill down amid widespread outrage, a good preview of the chaos to come. If you can't beat 'em, out-got 'em, said Catherine Rampell in the Washington Post. That seems to be the new creed of conservatives embittered by the legalization of same-sex marriage. Yet these religious liberty torchbearers forget that while there have always been legal protections for the free exercise of religion, those exemptions are granted only if they don't burden or harm others. That's why the Supreme Court ruled in 1968 against a barbecue chain that claimed the right to turn away black customers because the owner's religious beliefs compel him to oppose anti-integration of the races. Don't be fooled by claims of Christian victimhood, said Jeffrey Toobin in The New Yorker. those demanding a special license to discriminate against gay couples, be it bakers, photographers, or local officials, are really just the linear descendants of those who once claimed that God prohibited interracial marriage or integrated schools. But where do you draw the line, asks Damon Linker in TheWeek.com. Should, say, Christian colleges that teach traditional beliefs about marriage lose their federal funding, accreditation, and tax-exempt status? That would drive them out of business. America was founded on ideals of religious pluralism, forming faith organizations and small business owners to choose between survival and their religious convictions would mark a sea change in the country's historic attitude toward faith, and would be a dramatic step toward the draconian secularism enforced in France, where Christians can't even wear a cross to school or work. Christians are right to be worried, said Rod Dreher in Time.com. Those of us who still hold traditional values about sex and marriage need to accept we're living in a culturally post-Christian nation. The sexual revolution isn't going to be reversed anytime soon. We are going to have to learn how to live as exiles in our own country. Christians love portraying themselves as struggling under the pitiless gay boot heel, said Paul Waldman in WashingtonPost.com. Some are even warning, absurdly, that members of the clergy may be forced to perform same-sex weddings against their will. Are Catholic priests now forced to marry a Jew and a Protestant? No. Let's not forget that this very same Supreme Court has already proved its willingness to expand religious freedom, holding in last year's Hobby Lobby case that even a corporation can have its own religious beliefs. And in the gay marriage ruling, the court specifically reassured religious organizations that they'd receive proper protection under the First Amendment. Christians should relax. The government isn't coming to cart them off to a secular re-education camp. In the end, this will all get worked out. I don't think it will take all that long either, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. Same-sex marriage is unlike abortion, which has continued to divide the country. In just a decade, there has been an unprecedented swing in popular support for same-sex marriage, with about 60% of Americans now approving of it. What's more, the generational divide is cavernous. Some 73% of millennials support same-sex marriage, compared with just 39% of those in their 50s and 60s. Opposition to gay marriage is literally dying out. There will be no big backlash or titanic struggle over religious freedom. In a decade, we'll wonder what the fuss was all about. Surging Sanders, why Hillary is worried. Bernie Mintham is reshaping the Democratic presidential race, said Mary Alice Parks in ABCNews.com. As he mounts a populist campaign against presumptive nominee Hillary Rodham Clinton, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders is firing up the progressive base and drawing huge crowds across the country. A whopping 10,000 people showed up at a rally in Madison, Wisconsin, many sporting Feel the Burn t-shirts. Another 7,500 supporters in Portland, Maine, this week cheered as a 73-year-old self-styled socialist railed against billionaires and called income inequality the great moral issue of our time. One poll has Sanders within 8 points of Clinton in New Hampshire, and he has sliced her 45-point lead among Iowa caucus voters in half. Clinton's aides admit they have underestimated Sanders and that he might even win in Iowa, said Amy Chozick and Patrick Healy in the New York Times. One clear sign of anxiety, Clinton's surrogate, Senator Claire McCaskill, is openly dismissing Sanders as a fringe candidate peddling an extreme message. Actually, it's not even very extreme, said Matthew Pulver in Salon.com. The heart of Sanders' platform, higher taxes on the wealthy, single-payer health care, guaranteed workers' vacation and sick leave, raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour, is fairly standard post-war liberalism. It only seems radical today because Bill Clinton and his centrist Democrats moved the party to the right in the 1990s. Sanders' run reminds me of Eugene McCarthy's in 1968, said Michael Goodwin in the New York Post. President Lyndon Johnson initially seemed unbeatable, just as Hillary does today. But McCarthy rode anti-Vietnam War fervor to near victory in New Hampshire, ultimately driving a shaken LBJ from the race. Sanders doesn't have to beat Clinton in Iowa or New Hampshire, just showed that the scandal-ridden former Secretary of State is not inevitable. By the end, 2016 could be the new 1968. No way, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. Sanders' popularity surge is understandable because the rumpled Brooklyn native has a palpable authenticity that contrasts with Clinton's poll-driven, carefully curated, every hair in place campaign. But unlike LBJ, who was weighed down by the millstone of Vietnam, Clinton remains very popular among Democrats. She also has history on her side, since she could be the first woman elected president. Bernie should enjoy his surge, because it won't last. And wrapping things up with a few notes. Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton raised a record $45 million in the first 3 months of her 2016 presidential run. Her campaign says that more than 90% of that money came from individual donations of less than $100. Clinton's total tops Barack Obama's previous record of $41.9 million in the first 3 months of his 2012 reelection campaign. Adults obtained 53% of the 63 million prescriptions for medications treating ADHD last year. And a quote to finish us off from Michel de Montaigne, "The pleasantest things in the world are pleasant thoughts, and the great art of life is to have as many of those as possible." We've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Questions or comments? Give us a call, 919-832-5138.